want winners. I want people that want to win.
When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
You play to win the game. Hello? You play to win the game.
Come after me! I'm a man!
This week on Double Dragon, Steve and I invite an NFL analyst to talk about Game of Thrones with us. His name is Fran Duffy, and you will absolutely know him if you live in the Philadelphia area because he does analysis for the Philadelphia Eagles. So he's going to help Steve and I break down the first half season of House of the Dragon, and we will make some predictions for the second half of the season. No spoilers, I promise. And then medievalist Ian McGinnis joins us all the way from Scotland to talk about marriage alliances and castle sieges. All right. Without further ado, here is comic Steve Osborne and NFL analyst Fran Duffy. Now, Steve and I don't normally do video, so Steve's a little bit taken aback just to actually see what I look like.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could go video, but I'm gross.
Well, you're gross, but I won't use the video for the podcast, so feel free to be gross. It will actually help us lean into the sports theme.
If I'm gross. Yeah,
no, there's nothing like a gross guys talking about sports together.
Yeah, but that's actually, they just shortened that to sports talk.
So I'm with Steve Osborne, comic from San Francisco area. Steve's been on various radio programs from time to time, but also a sports fan. And then I thought, who better to bring on than a NFL analyst? And that would be Fran Duffy. So Fran, you are an expert on football. And so I thought if you could help us understand a little bit, there was a big scrum in the castle. So if you were actually going to have a fight in a castle, what kind of advice would you give to someone like Harwin Breakbones, who's actually trying to get to the other side of the hall? Did he run the right play in that case, or would you go in a different direction?
Well, it's funny. As you started asking the question, I was like, well, it helps to have someone named Breakbones on your side if you're in a situation like that.
Sure.
But the saying in football is low man wins. I don't know if he necessarily can help in that category, but he certainly was able to get the job done in that melee at the end of last week's episode.
Yeah,
I'm really glad that the showrunners enlisted Chris Berman to help them with the naming conventions for some of their... Yeah.
Night of Kisses definitely has sort of a Berman-esque nickname quality to it.
Yeah, he's a kicker, obviously.
Right. Okay, so I'd love to have your take, Fran, on the season so far. Just to remind folks, we have a rating system for Double Dragon. The Dorn is not a good episode. Danny is a decent episode. And a Dinklage is a very strong episode. So where would you rank, you know, through five episodes, where would you rank this season?
I mean, it's definitely leaning more towards Dinklage than Danny. I can't go full Dinklage for the entire season just because there have been some things, some elements of the storytelling, you know, especially when it came to like the crab feeder and that element of the battle strategy, especially looking at it from an X's and O's standpoint. There are things where I'm sitting there watching. I'm like, I don't know exactly what the thought process here. Why can't they get this done in the manner that they need?
The crab feeder was a bit like a high draft pick that kind of didn't pan out in my mind.
Yeah,
right. He had a lot of potential.
He made the sleepers list.
Yeah, exactly. To me, like, I think at the end of the day, five episodes in, this has been really strong, maybe stronger than I could have even hoped for. I was really excited. I think we had kind of reached that point. And it was funny just kind of listening to you guys recap, Steve, your first viewing of the original series and kind of leading that into this series. It was really kind of like, okay, I feel good about getting back into this universe now after how the last one ended. And so the first five episodes have been more than I could have even hoped. I'm really, really excited for the back five.
So you're going to say a Dinklage, but not properly Dinklage. It sounds like you're a little bit like Dinklage minus one, Dinklage minus two.
Yep.
All right.
I think that's fair. I would say like maybe a Dinklage minus two. I think it's kind of, it's pretty fair. You know, I think just the crab feeder element, and just some of the other like little quirks here and there that have bothered me a little bit.
Room
but
for
overall,
improvement,
I mean,
for sure.
Yeah, room for improvement, but still, I mean, outstanding. And that's the thing is, I think you guys said it best in talking about the original series that you were kind of a prisoner to those first 5-6 seasons, right? The expectations right. were so high. You know, trying to hold this show to that standard is still a difficult task, right? But to me, coming off at just straight face value, you have to be happy with how the first 5 episodes have gone.
All right, how about you, Steve? You're going to give this a high Danny? I'm guessing you're going to give it a high Danny.
I'm giving it a high Danny, but I am flirting with, I mean, I could be swayed to the Dinklage minus two because I do feel really good about this show. And it's interesting what you said, Fran, about how, like, you know, the first five seasons are kind of what you kind of like 5 to 6, but you hold the height of Game of Thrones. And in a way, I almost wonder now that we've had some time to really, you know, separate ourselves from the original series, is House of the Dragon maybe benefiting from the dip at the end? Whereas if let's say Game of Thrones finished, just hit all of our expectations and blew our minds, man, that's a whole other expectation, right? With House of the Dragon, because I mean that would be that Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul. Because Anthony and I have talked about, like, I was very reticent to go to the Better Call Saul universe just because I'm like, I don't want anything to even sort of mar my experience there. Whereas here, the experience is a little marred, and so you have maybe people have a little bit of hope for redemption. So that sort of gives people maybe a little bit more of an in to have maybe an open mind. I definitely think it's a high Danny flirting with a low Dinklage, which does make me nervous, right? I mean, it's like because you do have that like, well, are the wheels going to fall off this thing, or are we going to keep riding this up? Because if they can sustain this, because this is where I think it's really going to come down to, is this time jump is going to be the time jump, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is at least, I mean, there may be more, but this is the big one. We kind of knew it was coming. So the challenge here is, as Anthony and I have talked about, we've really grown to appreciate and enjoy these young actresses, and mm-hmm. to not have them anymore is going to be a bit jarring. Mm-hmm. So that there is a baked in. We already are disappointed without knowing if they're going to be disappointed long term or just by virtue of losing somebody.
Mm. This is a little bit like, you know, when you've got a quarterback in the wings. You got that quarterback that you know is the quarterback of the future, right? You've got these actors in the wings. You know you're going to bring in Darcy, and yet, man, you just fallen in love with that. You know, that franchise player. You know, you're not really ready to give up Montana yet. You know, Young has got potential, but
thanks for not making this a Lance Garoppolo thing, because at this point we know that these actresses have accomplished something. So it isn't like we're not basking in potential and hope. We know, Shanahan didn't run these actresses into the ground. They were actually producing.
And I also want to give the young actresses a little bit more credit than Jimmy Garoppolo, which, look, it took him to a Super Bowl, but, you know, there's a cap ceiling there, I think, when you look at, you know, his effect on that team. But I think ultimately those two did an outstanding job. I'm excited, though, for the second half to see what Darcy and the rest of the new actresses bring.
Okay, good. Let's translate.
Well, yeah, let's rate Garoppolo. I think, I mean, he's probably a Dorn plus two. I mean, he's properly Danny when he's managing a game. But I mean, you get him when the lights get bright. He's a Dorn.
I will transfer to the second half of the season. Now, I will mention, because I know people care about this, we will not traffic in spoilers in any of this, but we will be making predictions just based on what we've seen on screen.
All right. So our predictions could be spoilers, but that's not our fault.
And just, yeah, that's right. And it's not your fault because, Steve, if I understand it correctly, you've not read Fire and Blood. And Fran, you have not read Fire and Blood.
I don't read. I barely listen to this podcast.
So what I've asked both of you to do is come up with a power ranking of the folks who have potential to wield power in Westeros. And I'm just going to ask for your top five in the power ranking. And of course, you know, this is not necessarily who's going to sit on the Iron Throne. This is about who's going to hold the power. And as we know, you know, sometimes the person who's the most powerful in the kingdom is actually not sitting on the throne. So you know the characters involved. And so why don't we start with you, Steve? Do you have a power ranking for the remainder of the season?
5-1. We want to do our 5-1s here. So do we want to each do our five, or do we want to go around the table and go fifth and then fourth and then, you know, I know I'm producing on the fly.
Let's just hear your five.
So here, my five. Yeah,
Here, I'm asking for five names. Damn it. Is this hard? Just five names. See, this is not sports talk unless we actually start yelling at each other at some point. That's
right. You idiot. All right. And it's also not sports talk if it's not planned in advance. All right. So we're going top five. I'm going to put Rhaenyra in my five spot.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So this is of the five, this is the least. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Shocker. Yeah. Shocker.
It's hot takes. It's hot take Friday here at the Double Dragon podcast. No, I'm putting Rhaenyra at the five. I mean, I definitely think she's a power player, obviously. I mean, she's on the cover, but I feel like that might be, we're talking for the rest of this season.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'm for the rest of this season. This is kind of how I'm putting it. We're going to see her, I'm predicting, you know, she'd be thrust into thronedom, and that's going to be a lot, right? I mean, we're going to have a time jump, but I still think that there's going to be a lot that she's going to have to navigate, and I think the lack of agency will really come to fruition here, and I think it's going to be something that's going to bump her down a bit.
Wow. Okay. I thought she'd be higher. I will wait to hear
you. You do your list, I'll do mine.
Look, I've got thoughts. I've got thoughts on your list. I'm really curious to hear how you justify putting four characters above Rhaenyra. So let's hear it.
I'm going to put Alicent ahead of Rhaenyra at this point. At this point, I think what we saw in the last episode, Alicent is starting to come into her own. She's making some deliberate moves.
Yeah.
And I think she is just by virtue of, and we'll get to her father in a moment. But I think by virtue of having Otto on her side, and I think that's going to make a difference. So I think that's going to be, and she's got some inside, you know, she's inside in the walls, so to speak.
All right.
So I'm going to put Damon in the three spot. I think Damon, as a chaos agent, I think he almost has power by default, whether or not it's true political power in terms of power to influence and in terms of power to disrupt. I mean, outside of Daemon getting eaten by a dragon, I don't see how that's going away anytime soon. Number two, I am going to, this might be even more of a surprise. I'm going to put Laris.
You're going to put Larry. You're going to put Larry pretty high, huh?
Putting Larry in the two spot because, like Damon, I think that there's, you know, and again, maybe it's about how we're defining this power, but I think his influence is going to be, I think we're going to see, this is not the last of the influence I think we've seen, especially for this season. I think he inserted himself at the end of this time jump. I think it was intentional. I think we're going to see more of that, of his machinations.
Don't you feel like we have a bit of a small sample size with Larry? I mean, he killed it in that one scene. That's a lot to infer from that one scene.
I think that scene was put there at that time. What did that scene do for the rest of that episode?
Well, you're right. It had quite an impact for sure.
And again, I'm talking about. Power and not the, like you said, not throne sitting power, but we're talking about kingdom power, and we're talking the rest of the rest of the season. So I'm going to go with that, and I'm actually going to put Otto in the number one spot.
Wow!
I think Otto is he's got the ambition. I think he's got the planning. Now that he's got Alicent on his side, I think he's a dangerous man.
So you're thinking like puppeteer behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. All right, Fran. I'd be curious to see if you have any overlap here with Steve.
So I do have some overlap, and I also had Rhaenyra at number five. My big thing, the way I kind of looked at this was in my, you know, pure NFL draft analysis standpoint, I was like, all right, like, what are the traits that are required in order to to gain power, in this universe? And the strength, like the physical power that you present, your social standing, and then your social cunning, like your ability to be able to navigate these political waters. And so when I look at Rhaenyra, obviously she's gonna have power, and she has that social standing, but I don't know that she has the acuteness that is going to be needed to be able to navigate all this. She either has like deferred away from having those conversations, or just hasn't done well in the, and has been so quick to cut people off. I go back to like the third episode in the tent, when she's meeting with all of the other the ladies in that tent, and she quickly kind of shut people down. And you can kind of see that, yeah, like she knows that she's got power and she's got standing, but wasn't willing to be.
Yeah, it's almost like she doesn't have a taste for the political game, right?
No. And I think that's very similar to Damon in that respect. Like, that's the thing is, like, I went back and forth with her and Damon as 5-4, and that's why I actually have Damon at 4. He's physically strong as well, and obviously he's battle tested. But what I love about Damon is we never know what he's actually thinking. So many of his best scenes, he hasn't said a word, and there's been so much ambiguity with so many of his actions and trying to define his motivations. It's been really, really hard, almost on a weekly basis. And it's funny though, I don't know that anybody actually likes him. Like, the only person that I feel like actually likes him in this universe outside of his brother.
Rhaenyra likes him.
I think
for
obviously
sure,
Rhaenyra offers that as well. It certainly seems that way at the end of last episode. But I think when you look at the way that he has interacted with everybody else in this universe, I'm not sure that anybody else looks at him as like, we want him on our side. He's more of a necessary evil.
Sure.
At what point will that necessary evil be seen? Okay, it's time to cast him aside. Okay. And so I am fascinated to see what his long-term future is.
So he's kind of like a Christian. He's like a Christian McCaffrey, right? Like, he could easily go one, but I mean, can you trust him? Right. You know,
exactly. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, at some point, like, he is the ticking time bomb. As a viewer, we're watching this saying, like, I don't know what to think, because, like I said, there's been so much ambiguity with him. Uh-huh. At one point, I think early in the season, I thought, they're going to go Jaime Lannister arc with him, and they're going to make us hate him early, and then they're going to have us like him. The last couple of episodes have made me think, like, we're not going to actually like this character. Right. I'm still enthralled with him, but I don't know that we're actually going to say, like, oh yeah, like, he's actually a good guy. I don't know that we're going to be viewing him that way.
Well, what could you do with the character in five seasons? But I guess we're just looking at this first season at this point.
Yeah.
All right. So your number three would be.
So my number three is actually Corlys. And I think when you look at this is a guy that number one, he's willing to make tough decisions. He's put himself into a position of power. He already has established strength both with his navy and having half the realm's dragons. So when you look at the way that he is set already coming into the start of the series, yeah, I feel good about it, and he has only made himself stronger. Now we'll see what the fallout is from this wedding, and I'm fascinated to see what the fallout is from this wedding. How will he and his son take exactly what happened with Joffrey being pummeled to death by Kristen?
Yeah,
what is the fallout? But to me, Corlys is someone that has shown that he can. I think that he can play the game, off the field, and then on the battlefield has that as well. So I think he presents a really interesting combination of skills from that standpoint.
So I'm just going to pause this, and I'm going to make an observation. You both have put pretty low on your list the folks that actually have dragons. And I think that probably tells us something about this show. The dragons are an afterthought on this show. I don't even know if the showrunners know what to do with the dragons. It's absolutely politically driven. And I think that your list so far have shown that you value what the showrunners value. And that is, if you have a political strategy and if you have political capital, that absolutely has currency in this world. Whereas I think in the first series, it was like, well, Dany's got dragons. She's going to kick ass. I don't know. This is just an observation.
I wonder if part of that is that, you know, in the original series, there were no dragons when the show started. Here, that we know dragons are going away at some point, you know, so it's almost like, yeah, like the dragons are there. They're helping them right now. But there's going to be they're going to cancel each other out at some point. I am fascinated to see where like the battle lines are drawn, because I feel like there are going to be so many there's so many mixed relationships, you know, at this point. Where do the Valyrians end up on which side? And again, I have not done any of the reading here. I've been staying away from anything spoiler. I don't even watch like the look, you know, next week in the post credit. You know, I've been staying away from all of that. So I'm fascinated to see on what side of the ledger the Strongs fall. On what side of the ledger do the Valyrians fall? Do those families within themselves get split? Uh-huh. You know, I don't know. Like, is Larry working at the behest of his father when he's making this relationship with Allison, or is he working on his own?
Right.
You know, we saw already the Valyrians during that battle in the Stepstones. There were some fissures in that family, right? Like, they had, like, I don't know if that was Corlys's brother or if his cousin. You know, there were some friction there. So is there going to be a split in that family as well? I'm fascinated to see just exactly, because I think they're setting it up to say, okay, it's gonna be Rhaenyra versus Allison. Uh-huh. But if it's just all the dragons versus the Hightowers, that battle doesn't make any sense to me. So I think there's gonna be dragons on that side. It's just a matter of where they come from.
So Steve,
because my take on this is that all the people that I mentioned that I think are in a higher power position is because they know that the dragons can take out the other dragons. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, and I think that's where we're headed, right? I mean, the only thing that can beat the Targaryens is the Targaryens, and it's just a matter of how do you manipulate that? What side is that? And that's where I think I put Rhaenyra down a little bit lower, because if she doesn't see that coming, then she could be a pawn in that same game. And we're Daemon just a little bit higher, because I think he might be able to react a little bit.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. So it's almost like the dragons cancel each other out. And so then what do you have besides dragons? You've got to have savvy. You've got to have capital, right?
If the Targaryens were unified and it was all dragons on one side, I don't think we would have ever had Game of Thrones.
Well, I was just thinking about this. I was thinking, okay, Viserys does not have a dragon and Daemon does. But when Viserys walks into that party, Viserys has all the power. You know, there's no dragon in the room. All you got to do is take your brother out, and then no problem with the dragon, because the dragon's a non-issue.
Well, have you ever been like at a bar or a pub, and like there may be a lot of people like kind of like alpha males jockeying for position, but then like just one gross guy walks into the room?
No, I'd never experienced that, because I'm usually the gross guy.
Well, then you would know, why is it everybody seems to be retreating from me? Why is it that I get to go to the bar and seem to have all this attention by myself? There is a power that is wielded from no one wanting to touch you or be near you.
I'm finally understanding for the first time my entire life from this perspective.
A little bit of scab goes a long way.
Okay, Fran, your top two.
My top two. So I actually went with Larry. I went with Larys as well at number two.
Wow.
And to me, I kind of look at it. First of all, I love the fact that his name is Littlefinger and Varys put together. And so there's that element of it. Uh-huh. But also, if we were able to see Littlefinger 10 years prior, you know, maybe we would have only seen one scene, you know, lurking in the shadows, you know, by himself, kind of poking and prodding. But, you know, 10 years later, he becomes Littlefinger. I kind of think that's what they were teasing there with Larys in the garden. We saw him previously a couple episodes earlier, and just kind of setting the tone for what he was going to be. He's got his father, who has played all of his cards correctly from our vantage point so far. And obviously a brother. We don't know all the dynamics of that relationship, but Harwin Breakbones, an early fan favorite, just in limited screen time with what he's done. So I'm going to put Larys in there as more of a puppet master. Number one, I put Allison. And from the reason I put Allison in there, to me, the transformation that she underwent just in this one episode, the development we saw from her in episode five, you know, the only question I have with her right now is, when push comes to shove, like, is she going to be willing to make that really tough decision? Is she going to be willing to you know, put aside her friendship, lifelong friendship with Rhaenyra? It seems that way, but we haven't seen it. But I think when you have Otto behind her, and then the other ace in the hole, is young Aegon, mm-hmm. is having him where it seems like most of the realm, they're pointing to the fact that, yeah, most of the realm is going to rally behind Aegon, yeah. The namesake of the Conqueror, and everything that goes with him. I think that gives her so much strength. From a military standpoint, where does that strength come from? And I'm fascinated just to see again where that does happen to come from here in this debate. But to me, I put Allison at number one. I think that she's in the catbird seat coming out of episode 5.
Yeah, and that's a really I like that, and that's kind of, I think, where I went with Otto. But you know, that's, they're sort of combined there. And I think the other thing to consider too with Allison, why she's in a strong position, is don't sleep on Sir Criston Cole. That's another like, we talk about someone who has, you know, force, and someone who has motivation, and someone who could potentially be very loyal and manipulative. I mean, that's another piece that she does have. So
yeah, and Anthony, I said this to you, like the first thing that popped in my mind when at the wedding feast, when she comes in wearing the green dress and everyone kind of stops, and you can kind of, there's the tone felt to me, like my mind went to Sansa after Lyza Arryn was killed in the Vale, after Littlefinger kills Lyza Arryn. It said like, okay, this is a huge development point. This is a turning point for this character. This is a new version of Allison.
Yeah, so, this last episode did a lot to just put a bunch of capital right on her side of the field, right?
Yep.
Well, there's that. Like, I like the Sansa comparison, but then also there's shades of Cersei there too, right? I mean, in terms of the loyalty to the, and whatever it takes to protect my child kind of a concept. Mm. And so you wonder, like, does she have, but then that's a question I think that you pose, is does she have the capability to go to that next level? How far is she willing to go to those motivations? Mm. And I think that just makes her that much more intriguing, and it potentially dangerous, right? I mean, there is that. But the question in this world is like, dangerous to whom and what's for the best?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
okay, this brings us right to my number 5.
We're out of time though, but hey, thank you so much, Fran, for being with us today.
But
no, and it's fine. You know what? We'll put it up on social media. We don't have Instagram yet, but we'll get one.
Is it the Scabs? Is that what it is?
It was the Scabs. This is why we do this on Zoom.
So my list looks very different than both of yours. Number 5 for me is Aegon. And it's a little bit like drafting Bronny James. It's a little bit like you know, it's not like Bronny would go number 1, but he might go number 5 because that might bring LeBron to your city. Right? So maybe Bronny has that sway. So anyway, I'm going Aegon. I think that we're going to level up in the next episode. We're going to actually see a young Aegon. And for all of the reasons that you were saying Alicent has potential, I think that Aegon is nothing but potential. And that guy might get himself a dragon. And that's the potential that he has that other players may not have. Allison is not going to get a dragon. Otto is not going to get a dragon. Aegon might, and that might.
Yeah, but she would. But she might be. She's has a dragon in law, because she's the mom.
It's true. It's true. All right. So second on my list is Daemon, for all the reasons that you mentioned. He's not higher. He's chaos. He's absolute chaos. So unless you can kind of figure out how to bridle that chaos, and kind of point him in the right direction, you can't really trust him. And I kind of feel like, of course, he has the most potential. He has a high ceiling. And yet you kind of are just waiting for him to implode.
He's Carson Wentz.
He's, yes. Right. There you go. Third on my list is Alicent. And I think this is high for her. And I just want to mention again, she's got on her side, she's got Criston Cole. She's got Otto behind the scenes. And potentially Larys. It could be that if he's offering an alliance to her and she realizes what she has in him, that could be a really great asset for her. All right. Now, I'm going to put a guy on the list that hasn't been on any list yet, and I'm going to put him number 2, and that is Lionel Strong. All right. And here's why. This guy, I don't think anyone's playing the Game of Thrones better than this guy.
Yep.
This guy has not overplayed his hand. He's been playing the long game. there was a nod he gave to Harwin right before Harwin kicks ass in that ballroom. When he gives the nod to Harwin, that tells me who has the power in this family. It's Lionel. And it makes me think, this family is really tight-knit. I feel like that doesn't just tell me about Harwin. It also tells me that Lionel probably has that same authority over Laris.
Yeah.
So if you give Lionel those two boys, and now he's connected in some way to Alicent, I think that's the real maybe power behind the throne. Right,
so he's going full Palpatine, carrying both sides of this. Okay,
that's right. It. Yes, exactly. And then I'm going to put Rhaenyra number one.
Wow.
And the reason why is, you know, of course she has that FU attitude that you like to see, and she's got a dragon, and I think she's politically smart. I think in her youth she didn't care about politics. I think that when we see her level up, we're going to see a more mature version of Rhaenyra, and I think that's going to make all the difference. So I've got her at the top of my power ranking, and I think it's important that the person at the top has access to a dragon, just because I think at some point they're going to want to do a spectacle on screen, and that's going to involve some sort of battle with a dragon.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move. House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you. In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers. If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right, so let's go down our just real quick. All right, so my top is Rhaenyra, then Lionel, then Alicent, then Daemon, then Aegon. Fran, could you recap yours?
Yeah, so from top to bottom, I went Alicent, Corlys, Alicent, Larys, Corlys, Daemon, Rhaenyra.
Okay, and Steve?
Yeah, my number one, I had Otto.
You feel bad about that now? You want to change it now?
No, I give Otto a lot of credit.
Okay.
Yeah, because I still think as powerful as Alicent may be, I still think that he wields a little more power just by virtue of being the father and having a little more influence. So I think the whole for me this whole thing has been agency and maybe perceived agency, and so I think that Otto actually being a little more removed gives him even more ability to manipulate things because now the appearances aren't so much a factor as the hand. That's just my thought.
Right.
So I put Otto still there. And then number two, I had Larry the Cucumber. Then it was Allison, then it was Daemon, then it was Rhaenyra.
Yeah, all right. These lists are very different. I thought we may have a lot of overlap, but these are considerably different takes on the show. All right, finally, I want to hear your MVP. Now, we'll do this in two stages here. I want to hear your MVP of the season so far.
Yep.
And then I'd like to hear who do you think has the most potential to be MVP at the end of the season? So let's start with you, Fran.
My MVP through the first five episodes is Viserys.
Yeah.
To me, you know, Paddy Considine, he was awesome in the role. We saw so much range. It was such a wild ride, a wild variance of emotions with him through five episodes. And early on, it was just fascinating to see a good-hearted king in this universe because we didn't have that. But we also know that nobility and kindliness typically does not get you far in this world. Right. So you knew it was not going to end well. Very similar to like a Ned Stark, I feel like his death is going to have kind of a House of Cards effect on all the other pieces on the board.
Huh.
You know, he was very much the interconnected tissue between everybody else that's involved in the story. And so I'm assuming, and again, we'll wait to see. I know you don't want to say, Anthony, exactly what happens with him at the end of this episode. I'm assuming that he is no more 10 years from now, but I'm fascinated to see, okay, when you remove him from the equation, how does that impact everybody else around him?
Every indication on screen is this guy is not going to be around for very long.
Yes.
Right.
You know, Otto said that best with his conversation with Allison as he was leaving. At some point, it's going to happen, likely sooner rather than later, based off what we saw. But to me, if we're just going just off the first five, I would say Viserys is my MVP.
All right, I'm going to go next. We'll give Steve the privilege of going last. I'm going to say Daemon. I feel like in just for the first five episodes, no one steals a scene like Daemon. It's like I care about everyone. You know, I'm interested in almost every character. That says a lot. You know, this is an ensemble cast. To say that I'm interested in every character says a lot. But there's no character that when he walks onto the scene, you know he's going to steal a scene. And he does it every time. So I think it's probably him MVP for the first five. I think over the next five, probably Alicent.
Yep.
All right. So go ahead, Steve.
So I mean, I both of you made great points. I'm sticking with Fran on this one. I think Viserys is my MVP. I agree that I don't think anybody does more to disrupt and draw attention quite like Daemon does. But in terms of just, for me, watching Paddy Considine's performance is I just can't get enough of it, right? I mean, I love when Daemon comes in, but at the same time, I also watched him run towards a crab feeder for, like, no real good reason. And so that I got to drop him a notch on that one. I feel like there's not a wasted moment with Viserys. Uh-huh. I feel like it's going to be, and I'm going to miss that character. I'm going to miss that performance quite a bit. Yeah. And so that's why I think for the rest, I'll bump Daemon up. I think, you know, body of work in the first five, I think with the next five, I think he's got the opportunity to run away with the season long MVP. Uh-huh. Because it's just one of those things where like, if Derrick Henry doesn't blow out his knee, who knows what happens? Like it's all these, you know, Viserys, if he could have just stayed healthy for the whole season.
Well, he's a little bit like Ned Stark in that, Like, you can't. The first season of Game of Thrones does not work with without Ned Stark. And his death has such an impact. It's like his death is this black hole, and everything is going to be reoriented around that force of gravity. So I think that to get us to care as much as we do about Viserys five episodes in is quite a narrative feat. I honestly do care to see what happens, around that black hole once he's gone. I think he might be the kind of character like Ned Stark that we continue to talk about long after his death. Mm. So, Steve, did you give us the MVP for the rest of the season?
Yeah, it was Daemon.
Daemon. Ooh, say more about that.
Well, I just think that, again, like the work that he did, and because I was between the two of them, and then I figured, well, one of them's going to still be around, so he's got a good chance to he'll I think he's here to disrupt as much as possible. And I think it's going to be really interesting to watch him with the absence of Viserys, right? So Viserys sort of kept him, actually literally alive in many cases, right?
Yeah.
And he has Rhaenyra on the throne, and they have a special relationship, but that relationship is complicated in a very Targaryen way. Uh-huh. So I think that adds, like, he has a sway over his brother just by virtue of their of them being brothers, but his sway with Rhaenyra is different, and it is much more of a dance, it feels like, between the two of them. So I think as we head into the Dance of the Dragons, those two I think occupy a lot of space in that regard.
So yeah, so what does Daemon look like once his brother's not holding him in check?
Yep.
I mean, his brother's not holding him in check all that much, but he always defers to his brother in the end. And you could credit Daemon also for sort of always defying his brother, but they're always playing this little game with each other. When Daemon no longer has a partner to play that game with, what kind of chaos monster does he become? So that's an interesting read on him for sure.
Well, because he does have a relationship with Rhaenyra, but not when she's the queen, right? Like as a princess, a child. And so like the power dynamic has shifted in the same way that the brother's power dynamic has shifted, because Viserys is like, well, he's on the throne, even though he was, the mom always liked you best mentality. But with Rhaenyra, like she will wield that power different than Viserys, especially in their relationship, which may create a different type of chaos monster.
My goodness. All right. Hot take. I've asked you all for one hot take, and I've asked you to be bold. So this is Hot Take Friday. Steve, what is your hot take?
So I had a couple of hot takes, but I think the hot take that I was hoping for was that Otto would be the one that we see as being comes out this thing pretty victorious. That's why I stick with my number one as Otto.
Right.
I think Otto is going to, I think when this season is over, Otto is going to be a much bigger part of this equation.
All right. So Otto as puppeteer is your hot take. I think that's a good hot take. Because I would have never come up with it, and yet it seems very plausible given the show's investment in him so far. Okay, Fran, your hot take.
So you kind of alluded to this with your top five in your power rankings, Anthony, and maybe it's not like super, super hot. It's just that we have not seen this character yet, but that Aegon was the last one standing amongst everybody. And that was, but after talking it through, maybe it's not like a Dragonfire hot enough take. Maybe it's something like Viserys doesn't die and he just becomes like the next crab feeder because of his skin just gradually falling off. Looking at Aegon and just how he is set up, right. I'm fascinated to see the character. Obviously we're aware of the actor who's playing him. Yeah, I'm fascinated to see him in this role. What he could be, it's such a wild card.
So
and not knowing anything
exactly
about it,
he's a wild card, because what if he comes out the gate like Tommen, and so it's like now Alicent has all the power. Or he could come out the gate like Joffrey, and then it's like doesn't matter what Alicent says at all. Joffrey's going to be Joffrey. So, yep. Yeah, you're right. He's like all potential at this point.
you know, you scroll through like social media and like the algorithm has me pegged, and I see like a graphic that's like, oh, this is how you get from Rhaenyra to Daenerys. I'm like, nope, so scroll through it. Don't want this. I don't want to see anything. So I don't want to see exactly how Aegon is going to pan out, but fascinated to see it all play out.
Okay, here's my hot take. My hot take is that Bran Stark is watching this whole thing through the Weirwood tree. Bran Stark's watching the whole thing through the Weirwood tree. He's going to start meddling. He's going to start meddling because that's exactly what the Weirwood tree is there for. That's why you keep doing that zoom in shot on the Weirwood tree. We know that Bran Stark's watching through those eyeballs. This is absolutely going to connect to the way that Game of Thrones ends, and the show will then plummet.
Because this whole thing was a way to retcon and say, look, we're going to tell you why this was a good move.
We're going to finally get why Bran, which should have been interesting to us all along. This the second half of the season is going to be all about Bran Stark's creepily gazing through the Weirwood tree eyes.
So instead of this being the Better Call Saul to Breaking Bad, yeah, this is the Three's a Crowd to Three's Company.
Very good. Yes, absolutely. And Laris will trip over a couch at some point.
That's perfect. Yeah, they do just start referring to him as Larry because he's actually played by Larry from Three's Company. All Jonathan right. Taylor Thomas is plays a dominant character. I would love to see Jonathan Taylor Thomas as the Aegon role, by the way, like eventually.
All right, Steve, if people want to follow you on social media, where can they find you?
You can follow me on Instagram at Ozfest, AUSFEST, for all of my photographic going ons. And maybe you'll see a clip of me at a Corey Feldman concert. Who knows?
Ooh, don't tease us if it's not true.
Oh, there's plenty.
And then, Fran, where can people follow you?
Sure. So you can follow me on Twitter at EaglesXOs. That's where I do all of my like football analysis stuff. I host a couple podcasts just covering the NFL, NFL Draft, the Journey to the Draft podcast, and the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast. So mostly, if I would say like 98% football over on that feed, but I will dabble in what I'm watching on TV every once in a while as well.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate you jumping on here. I'm really, given what you've said, I will now be watching this show through your predictions. And maybe we get back together at the end of the season and see who has to eat crow.
Yeah, we're going to have any kind of like, you know, instead of having like a trophy for the winner, is there some sort of like feat of shame for the loser?
That's good. Let's all think about what a good feat of shame would be. I think for Fran, he's going to have to wear a New York Giants jacket or hat or something.
I'm stuck on you saying eating crow because obviously that carries a lot more weight in the in this show that we're talking about.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Okay, this is a question from Foxy Crone 42. Did marriage pacts between political rivals actually work? In other words, did the men in charge actually honor these pacts? And what would happen to the wives when the men went to war anyway?
Yeah, so I think that there's kind of two parts to that question. So in regards to the first point, I think marriages were often a means of arranging alliances, of making new agreements between families, and indeed of sealing peace agreements between formerly warring kingdoms. So again, the example of England and Scotland, David, he's the heir to Robert the First, is married off to Joan of the Tower, the younger sister of Edward the Third, and they're married at a very young age, and they're like 6 and 9 or something.
Really?
When they're married. So it's very much a political match, and that's all it is.
Wow.
But their rather unhappy marriage over the decades that follow, I think, show that it was a political match, and it doesn't work out. Certainly doesn't produce offspring. So it didn't work in that sense. But yes, David and his various mistresses probably didn't help contribute to that. Although, of course, David was also spent various time away from Scotland anyway. But you do also have examples of, because a lot of these young these women were often young women, and at various times they would be married to older men, and so you do have some examples where they have multiple marriages, and you have to assume also quite unhappy marriages, as they are young women married off to older men who then die, and so they're married off to another older man who dies. You know that.
Now, when you say multiple marriages, you don't mean simultaneously.
No, of course. But if you're a young heiress who comes with a parcel of territory because you are your father's only heir, then you are a prize,
and
you may well be married off to other important men, especially by kings who are looking to solidify, you know, the and reward those around them. Then yes, you'll marry them off to one of those friends of the king. But if they get killed in battle, or if they are older anyway and die a few years later, then these women end up then in a succession of marriages. Yes, not at the same time, but a succession of what you have to assume are rather unhappy marriages. In regards to the second part of the question, though, in terms of what women do when their husbands are away, I think that's quite an interesting question, which has different answers. Again, it rather depends on the women involved. So you do have some women who go on campaign with their husbands. So Eleanor of Aquitaine, for example, joins her husband, Louis VII of France, on the Second Crusade. Mary of Guelders, the Queen of Scotland, joins James II at the Siege of Roxburgh. And indeed, apparently, successfully ends the siege when he's killed by one of his own cannons exploding siege goes on. No. But there are other examples of women who remain at home, but who find themselves in a military situation anyway because the castles that they are in are besieged. So there's the example of Nicolette de la Haye, who's the daughter of the constable at Lincoln Castle. During the period of rebellion against King John, she leads the defense of Lincoln against English forces who supported Prince Louis of France. Eleanor, the Countess of Leicester, during the Barons' War in the 13th century in England, leads the defence of Dover and goes into exile after she negotiates its surrender. And again, the Scottish Wars of Independence seems to be full of examples of noble women who are besieged and who lead the siege. So Agnes Randolph, the Countess of Dunbar, leads the siege of Dunbar Castle. Christina Bruce holds out at Kildrummy when she's besieged by Anglo-Scottish forces. That seems to happen relatively commonly.
Really?
And it's that interesting position then of the noble woman and the power and also, you know, the rights that are invested in her in terms of the defense of the castle. She has responsibility in normal times for the household, for feeding those within, and those types of responsibilities also translate into wartime as well. And so it does seem to be, for some at least, a relatively seamless transition from peacetime to wartime, that it just also includes then leadership of that household in war, but it does provide some really interesting examples. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up question then. So this is just one of my own questions. Is I get the sense that on the battlefield, although there are a few notable exceptions, it's mostly a male affair, right?
Yes.
And that would sort of be, you know, out armored, you know, weaponized soldiery, but it seems like women have an important part to play in castle defense. Would that have been considered a wartime duty of a lady of a great house to defend the, you know, sort of manage the guard and defend the castle?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was because I think again I think the peacetime responsibilities that are associated with noble women, you know, that control of the household, the arrangement of foodstuffs and making sure that people are fed, the real relationships you'll have to develop with the extended members of the household. I think that does translate relatively neatly when the castle is then under siege. There are similar responsibilities required of her. It's just in a very different scenario. I mean, I think, again, we have to be slightly cautious about this because our historical accounts of these episodes are written by men, and they're written in such a way as sometimes to reduce the agency or the involvement of these women in the siege. And you know,
you don't want to shame the men. That's
no, exactly. Well, absolutely not. And
sort of primary motivation for writing history: just make the men look good.
Absolutely. So that example of Eleanor de Montfort in Dover, her case is particularly interesting because the household accounts for her time there actually survive for a decent chunk of the period in which she was there. And so you can see her ordering supplies for her garrison. You can see the actions that she's taken in controlling the castle and ensuring its successful operation. So that does suggest that these women were far more involved than you might assume them to be, and what, far more than our chronicles might suggest. Our chronicles very often depict what these women are doing in very feminine ways, even if it's within the more masculine, in inverted commas, context of war. So that example I use of Agnes Randolph at Dunbar, when the English fire siege weapons at the castle, when a stone thuds off the castle wall, apparently Agnes sent out one of her maids dressed as a bride to dust off the spot at which it was, at which the stone hit the castle wall. And all of this is intended to antagonize the English. She's using these, or she's being depicted as using these kind of feminine symbols to piss off the English. She apparently also sends them supplies when the English are struggling with foodstuffs. And again, it's a, you know, stuff you, you know, we've got plenty of food. We can give some to you. You know, so all of this is, but again, this is how this is depicted, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's how it is.
Well, just to connect the dots for anyone that's listening. So I guess one of the main things that you would do with a siege is you would just wait the people on the inside out, and part of that game was just to try to wait long enough so that they'd run out of food supplies, right? You're trying to starve the people in the castle.
Yeah. Encirclement and starving them out would be a logical.
And so what she's doing is she's saying, look, we've got so much food. Yeah. We can share it. We'll even share it with our enemies.
Absolutely. And it is just, you know, it is very deliberately goading the English. And Agnes apparently sets up at one point to try and capture the English commander, William Montague. She asks for negotiations, and Montague comes to enter the castle for those talks, and one of his knights pushes him out the way and says, no, my lord, I'll go first. And he goes in, and then the portcullis drops behind him, and Agnes rather tauntingly said adieu, Monsieur Montague, as she leads away his knight into captivity. But it was very obviously a trap to try and capture the English commander.